In her new book, veteran journalist Carrie Lester reveals dozens of stories from Illinois women in government and their battles against sexual harassment, including Attorney General Lisa Madigan and Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox.
I'd spent a number of years down here covering politics, and sometimes this place seems like a frat house.
That's Carrie Lester. State Representative Sarah Feigenholtz and Senator Karen McConaughey share their stories about the Me Too movement in the State House. Plus, you might have heard there's a little movie called Black Panther out now.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
It's a third world country.
Textiles, shepherds, cool outfits,
all the front.
What do you know about Wakanda in the world of Black Panther? It's expected to break the bank at the box office for one, but for many, it's more than a movie, it's a movement. I talk with film critic Reggie Ponder later this hour. Stay tuned, that's all coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. News of the Me Too movement hitting state politics and our state capital, Springfield, this week reached a new level to House Speaker Michael Madigan's office. One of Speaker Madigan's longtime aides, Kevin Quinn, was fired earlier this week after public accusations by political consultant Elena Hampton went public. That was as the Chicago Tribune published a series of text messages over months from her supervisor. Here's Hampton earlier this week.
I managed the unwanted attention for 5 months. I asked him to stop 7 times. It never stopped.
The political fallout from that will continue. This has been an ongoing conversation in the Capitol, in the State House, sexual harassment and conversations from women at all levels, not just political consultants like Elena Hampton, but other lawmakers and journalists. And there's a new book out that details a lot of these stories. Carrie Lester covered politics for more than a decade for the Daily Herald and the Associated Press. She's just out with a new book. It's called Know My Place: Reflections on Sexual Harassment in Illinois Government and Politics. Carrie's actually in studio with me here at NPR Illinois. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me on.
So you've been, as I mentioned, a longtime political reporter. How did this book come about?
Well, Nyla, as the Me Too movement was bubbling up nationally and in Illinois, if we go back to the end of the year in late October, there was a letter that was circulated and signed by over 200 men and women in Illinois politics and government, mostly women, but some men, talking about this rampant culture of harassment and discrimination in Illinois politics. And I was one of the individuals who signed that letter. As you know, reporters don't typically get involved in political causes, but I didn't really view this as a political cause. I viewed this as a civility issue. I'd spent a number of years down here covering politics, and sometimes this place seems like a frat house. So I was thinking about all this, and in both reporting and reading the news on Me Too, I found that the breadth and the depth of women's experiences couldn't adequately be conveyed in a newspaper or magazine article. So I just thought about a way to try to illustrate that collectivity. And so I started talking to different women throughout the political sphere, everybody from people from the Illinois Attorney General and the Cook County State's Attorney to members of the General Assembly, staffers, lobbyists, and lawyers and consultants.
And even reporting interns, journalism reporting interns.
Right. There's a former public affairs reporting intern that is profiled in the book, and she has a pretty unique perspective. She was pregnant at the time of her internship and encountered some uncomfortable advances from her position.
The stories that are in this are, some of them are horrifying. A lot of them are, I would say, they were all disturbing. How did you go about collecting? And they do run, as I said, you know, we talk about the law. There are lawmakers and women who experience this, but then there are the women that you don't necessarily have, who aren't so visible in the Capitol, the staff and the lobbyists, other journalists. Does that to you sort of indicate the layers of how problematic this is, that this is something that reaches every level?
Absolutely. I was aiming to collect a range of voices and then also beyond that illustrate that it strikes women of every race and ethnic background. It strikes women all around the state and in different positions. Now, something that Attorney General Lisa Madigan did reflect upon is, you know, when you are in a position of power, that does change the dynamic. But what it doesn't change is that these women on their way to a powerful position nearly always encountered harassment or sexist behavior of some sort.
And even Lisa Madigan, her father, House Speaker Michael Madigan, who we were just talking about at the beginning, arguably one of, if not the most powerful politicians in the state. And she has stories of how men would make inappropriate comments to her when her parents were in the room, when she was younger. That really just stuck in my head, just thinking, are you kidding? Like those – she shared these stories with you.
Right, the brazenness of it. And I think there's a lot of like bombshell moments where that these women describe that make your jaw drop. And you feel terrible for them. You feel sorry that they went through these experiences. And there's a similar – and we can get into this later reaction to these inappropriate behaviors, or, you know, women kind of freeze up and react when they feel like it's too late and then replay the event. But with Lisa Madigan, I was surprised where the different experiences she had. She said she was, you know, catcalled on the street. She was harassed at events with her parents, and she had somebody stalk her in the state capitol as a young senator. And even from her perspective, in a very political family, she said that she felt at the time, and now this was 20 years ago when she was in the state senate, that she felt lucky to have a seat. And she felt that this was something that women had to put up with. And at that time, she wasn't brave enough to speak out about it.
Josie Morita from the Water Reclamation Commissioner says something when she shares her story. And she says when she was beginning in politics, no one ever pulled her aside and said, this might happen to you. And that's kind of also a theme of these stories of women, as you said, being sort of shocked, being not prepared. Do you think that that's changing? Do you think that publishing these stories will change that?
I do. I think that's a small silver lining to all this, that women are becoming more emboldened to speak out. And I think that they do not wish for their experiences to be passed on to another generation. I mean, you have everybody from a state senator in her 60s, State Senator Karen McConaughey, saying, you know, I feel responsible to a younger generation of women, to somebody like Morita, who is still in her 30s, saying, I wish I was prepared when I went out on the campaign trail.
I think the one thing that is a common thread from these stories is how can you be prepared for something like this, for the comments that people make to you or the actions?
Right. And what and I alluded to this a few moments ago, what these women often talk about is when a harassing or a sexist comment is made to them, they freeze in the moment. And then they're coming up for air, the moment seems to pass. Morita had a racist and sexist remark about her genitalia made to her at a Democratic Party event by a Democratic committeeman. And she said, you know, by the time I decided whether to chase him down or yell at him or not, the moment was gone. And then this is something I don't think a lot of men know, is that women replay this over and over and over again for months and for years to follow. You know, how come I didn't handle that differently? How come I wasn't more prepared? And, you know, in many cases, you may not know how you're going to react, but I do think the freedom to talk about this with other women, to talk about the fact that this is inappropriate, that you're empowered to say, I don't get talked to like that in a professional setting, that can help you be prepared a little bit.
Well, and I also think there's part of this is, and I'm thinking in particular of Commissioner Morita, when that statement is, which I feel like is one of, if not the most sort of outrageous, horrific things that get said in the book to her, she kind of has a moment where she just thinks, did that just happen?
Right.
And I think that's kind of something I think as you and I, we were talking about this before we went on air, we've been in situations where people have said inappropriate things to us as journalists. And there is kind of this moment where as a woman, when someone says that, you do kind of have this moment where you think, did that just really happen also?
Right. Right. And I think there's also this fear. I had an instance where a high-level campaign chief was at a bar and he'd had a few drinks and he started questioning me about women's orgasms. And I didn't know how to respond. I extricated myself from the situation. I later reported it to his campaign manager, but I think there was some fear. And was I going to be viewed and doing something to bring this on? Was I going to be believed? And so I think turning the tables a little bit and turning the power dynamic into, you know, we're listening to women, we're believing women, we're believing these stories, and they're very commonplace, that's an important change in the dynamic.
My guest is Carrie Lester. She's an Illinois journalist, and she's the author of Know My Place, Reflections on Sexual Harassment in Illinois Government and Politics. Carrie, I want to get to how you found the different women and were able to share your stories, but I want to ask you first just about what I started this conversation with Elena Hampton, the young woman who has been speaking this week about her, what happened with her. It started when she was 23 years old and working under Kevin Quinn and Alderman Quinn, his brother. I was watching that, her press conference, and I was wondering if that moment would have been possible without all of these other women sharing their stories right now.
Right. Well, Nyla, and I do feel the need to issue a little bit of an ethical disclaimer. My husband is an attorney involved in some Democratic politics, and we don't talk about this at home. But just to be
clear,
letting
everybody know
about that, you feel the need as a journalist. But I think that I hope Ms. Hampton and others feel emboldened to tell their stories. I mean, she was not the first, but she's one of the first in a very high profile situation. You had Denise Rothheimer, who was the Lake County woman who disclosed, you know, some inappropriate exchanges between herself and Senator Ira Silverstein, come out with this first. And I think that women are starting to feel that allegations are taken seriously. But it's interesting. I have not covered the Hampton story, obviously, but in watching the press conference and in some of the details, you hear about the communications with the Madigan Ward office, and I think that one of her early comments was, you know, I don't want anybody to lose their job. I don't want anybody to get in trouble here, you know, and you wonder if the tenor and the tone will change over time as women become more empowered about this.
Well, she said, and this is what really struck me, she said, this was my last option to be speaking about this publicly. Her political career was on the line. And as you think of women like Denise Rothheimer, also a lobbyist, I wonder what it is, if you can explain to people who maybe are not enmeshed in politics in Springfield, who are not working or have had experiences in the state house, what the environment is like.
Right.
And you said something at the beginning that sometimes it's like a frat house.
Right. I think that fear of retaliation, Nyla, is a huge thing, both in the Capitol and Illinois politics in general. And
would you say that's an unfounded fear?
No, I wouldn't.
Because when you say fear, it almost makes it seem as if it's unreasonable.
Right, right. There in the book, there is a 31-year-old political consultant named Caitlin Duncan, and she talks about having a client who was a young member of the Chicago City Council several years ago, and every time she'd go to his house to work on something in a clearly professional setting, she said that he would put out beer and he'd ask her out on a date and she'd say, no, I have a boyfriend. I want to get back to work. I don't want to flirt with you. But ultimately, after she shut him down, he declined to pay her. And so, you know, you hear that kind of story. You hear stories of women who talk about their bills being killed or a brick being put on their bills because they rebuff a man's advances. So I think the fear of retaliation is out there, but I also think it's a very gray area. State Representative Sarah Feigenholtz, she's been a leader on this issue in the state capitol. She and I had breakfast a month or so ago, and she was talking about how, you know, in Springfield, this is a particularly gray area because it is people's job to get you to vote one way or another on a certain issue, and they're leveraging their power or their influence over you to do so. So is that explicitly harassment? No. But are there a lot of blurred lines? Absolutely.
And she also points out in the book, she says this to you, there's no human resources department in Springfield. There's no checks and balances in the caucus or within the executive branch office. And then so she calls the effort to change the culture in Springfield a belt and suspenders effort. Mm-hmm. I wonder, as a journalist, what you're hearing from all of the women that you spoke with about all of the different conversations and efforts that are going on now in the Capitol to try to prevent and change this culture.
In some ways, you heard about this a little bit with the budget impasse. You heard about these conversations of women behind the scenes who were frustrated by the impasse and really wanted to get something done. And I think that there's some carryover here. Feigenholz was talking about this in somewhat of a vague light. I mean, she didn't name names or anything. But there's a lot of women who are talking about, you know, how we use this moment that we're at and we get beyond just, you know, legislation that is there in name only. How do we really change the culture, and how do we change things, you know, beyond harassment training and reporting? That's very good, but that's the tip of the iceberg. And how do you turn around this fear of retaliation? How do you make the Capitol culture, you know, more open and inclusive and accepting? And that's a big question.
Do you feel like politicians are – they're elected officials. They're, you know, they're in public service. Should they be held to different standards when it comes to these things then? I don't want to say that we expect this kind of behavior in the corporate world or in Hollywood or things like that, but or that it's somehow more excusable. But I wonder if there's an irony or even a different standard when we're talking about our elected officials.
Especially in politics, there can't be this boys will be boys mentality. I think that a lot of women, it would be very odd to them that for the tables to be turned and for them to feel like they could make, you know, these passing comments that women disclosed to me in their various interviews. And I just think that politics should be a safe place.
Powerful stories in Carrie Lester's book. It's called Know My Place, Reflections on Sexual Harassment in Illinois Government and Politics. Carrie, thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Nyla.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, we were speaking with longtime journalist Carrie Lester. She's written a new book about sexual harassment in Illinois politics. It's called Know My Place, Reflections on Sexual Harassment in Illinois Government and Politics. Carrie interviewed women lawmakers, lobbyists, and journalists. All of them share their stories of being harassed in Springfield. We'd like to share conversations we had this week with two of those women in her book, both of whom are current state legislators. First, I had a chance to speak with State Senator Karen McConaughey while we were at the state capitol. She's a Republican representing Illinois' 33rd Senate District, which includes areas northwest of Chicago, including South Elgin and St. Charles. Before becoming a senator, she was also the first woman in Illinois to chair a county board. That was 14 years ago in Kane County. And I started by asking her if she was treated equally by her male colleagues at the time.
Well, unfortunately, and I think all of it's unfortunate, and I, you know, always like to also point out that we worked through that and got to a point where my male colleagues and I, you know, held each other in appropriate respect for one another. But that wasn't necessarily an easy road getting there. You know, I think that you get held to a higher standard. You know, you hear this all the time where women talk about the fact that when men get angry, oh, they're strong, they're forceful. But women are forceful and strong.
We're difficult. Right.
We're difficult. And so that sums up a lot of what I had to deal with. I think also part of it was sort of that sense, well, you this is what we're going to do, and I know you're going to, we know you'll just go along with it, sort of attitude by my male counterparts. But being a strong personality and pushing back is what all women who find themselves in a position of authority have to go through. They go through that testing. I've never met a woman yet who hasn't worked hard to get to a position of authority that didn't endure that.
And that's what you said. You said, I knew if I wanted to get ahead, I would have to suck things up and not
right.
dwell on disrespectful
Correct.
Or inappropriate behavior.
Right.
That's just unacceptable. Women should never have to put up with this.
Right.
What kind of culture's change? Do you think it's a cultural change that we need in order for future generations of
yeah.
women?
Yeah, I think it is a cultural change. Just as the things that I've described and talked about were just the way it was, right? That was the culture I grew up in, was that, hey, if you wanted to get ahead, you're just going to have to put up with it. I don't want that for my daughters. I don't want that for my – I have five granddaughters. I don't want that for them. And I think that women who – and we've all, in our own way, have suffered some of the sort of disrespectful behavior that is cultural. I think the conversation that's taking place, not just here but all across the United States, is long overdue, and is a very important conversation. That one of the things that you realize as you have this conversation, a lot of the men say, "I never really understood it before," because I think I think women did their level best to ignore it.
Are male lawmakers saying that to you now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Never really understood, how pervasive it is. The problem is really pervasive. You can't turn the TV on or turn the radio on and not hear about another situation right here in the Capitol. We just had another one, out of the Speaker's office.
This week, right.
And again, what's the message we're getting out of that? The message is that women do not feel that they will be taken serious when they come forward with a complaint about a male colleague's behavior. They just don't.
And I wanted to ask you, you sit on the Legislative Ethics Commission. What can you tell us about the current process that's used here in the Capitol that the General Assembly uses to address cases of sexual assault and harassment? We know that there were cases that were piling up.
Right.
There was no Inspector General. So now that there is an Inspector General, what's the process looking like?
So understand that historically, it's the four leaders who pick, make the decision, and recommend it to the General Assembly who the Inspector General will be.
And do you think that's a good idea?
No, I don't, because that's the fox guarding the hen house. The person who has the responsibility to investigate unethical behaviors or inappropriate behaviors should be completely independent. Because if you or I need to bring a complaint forward, we need to know that the person who's going to take our complaint, consider it, investigate it, and make a determination is doing so with complete independence. Our process does not allow for that. So the commission, so we do have one now, but that was only done under pressure, quite frankly. I was the one that made people aware that there was 27 that we on the commission didn't even know about. 27 complaints had been sitting there for up to three years. Literally for years. So think about, I don't know if some of them may be male or female, but think about those people who filed a complaint and never even got an acknowledgement that their complaint had been considered. So what does that say to any other woman who is working in an intolerable situation in the workplace? Why would any woman think that justice is going to be served?
So, Senator, what do you think needs to be done? You've said it needs this entire process of addressing sexual harassment in the State House needs to be removed from the control of the General Assembly. What else?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that need to happen in terms of the makeup of the commission. The commission should be made up of not just legislators. I do think a jury of your peers is important, but I also think that you need to have people who are completely independent of the General Assembly, who serve in that judicial role, which is essentially what the commission does. So the Inspector General investigates, comes up with a finding, and brings it to the commission. Then the commission makes a decision on what the next steps will be. We need more transparency. The general public has a right to know what the outcomes are on these things. Now, the privacy of the person making the allegation and the person who's being accused, the confidentiality of that needs to be maintained for both parties. But once there's a determination that an incident did take place, people have a right to know. You can't fine a legislator. You can't say, well, that's a $5,000 fine for you. Can't do that. We're elected. You can't fire us. My leader can't fire me if I'm found guilty of something. So the only way a legislator is really held accountable is with the voter.
you mentioned that you have 5 granddaughters.
Right.
I'm curious your perspective looking at what's happening now versus in your almost 3-decade career in politics.
Well, I do. Well, let me answer two ways. One, in the broader sense, I do think there is a difference because we are beginning to, for the first time, see real consequence for behavior. And so until there is a consequence for behavior, you're not going to change it, right?
And public consequences.
And public consequences. Look, I mean, we're talking a lot of high-profile people who whose careers are over because of their behavior. That is exactly the kind of action that needs to take place that help women understand it's okay to come forward. You don't have to hide. You don't have to pretend like it didn't happen. You are okay. It's okay to come forward. I think here in Springfield, it's a little more complicated. There's a much more entrenched culture here. I think it's a little more difficult. I don't expect that the leaders are going to relinquish control of that process very easily. But I think that the women who serve in this building really want to take this opportunity of what's going on nationally and in the conversation that's taking place to really keep pushing until we get real reform in this area.
So the idea that there's training happening, is that helpful?
Well, you know what? It's too early to tell whether it's working. And I'm not saying that the training isn't important. It is. But let's not for one second think that that's where it ends or that it should end. And my fear is that there are some people in this building who think, well, as long as we have training, it's all good. No, it's not quite that easy. And the laws that we have on the books need more work. There's a task force to come up with additional recommendations that will produce a report. I'm on that commission. There's also another thing I'll point out is that there is, in the Senate, we have formed a bipartisan women's caucus. First time ever. We'd been talking about it for a long time. But this issue really kind of brought it into focus because the people who were running the bills when we did that knee-jerk reaction to what happened with the Harvey Weinstein situation, those bills were carried by men and very little input coming from female legislators. So I think female legislators have a distinct perspective, not just on sexual harassment, but on a whole array of issues that uniquely impact us as wives and mothers. And so really formalizing a united effort on the part of women legislators to address policy in a more holistic way that are good for the people of Illinois, namely women and children, we hope will make some difference around here.
Senator Karen McConaughey is a Republican. She represents Illinois' 33rd Senate District, northwest of Chicago, St. Charles, South Elgin. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Again, that was Republican Senator Karen McConaughey earlier this week. She and others have said this is an issue that affects women of all political parties. This week, I also spoke with a lawmaker from the other side of the aisle who's also in Carrie Lester's book. State Representative Sarah Feigenholtz is a Democrat from Illinois' 12th Health District that includes Chicago's near north neighborhoods of Lakeview and Lincoln Park, among others. We caught up on the phone yesterday afternoon. Representative Feigenholtz, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
Representative, you spoke in Carrie Lester's book about how you were sexually harassed while you were working on a campaign by a man who outranked you. And I can't help but think about what we heard earlier in the week from Elena Hampton, who got inappropriate messages from Kevin Quinn, who worked in Speaker Madigan's office for months. And there surely must be many women who decided to stop working in politics altogether after having these kind of experiences. So I want to start by asking, was it hard for you to decide whether you wanted to continue to pursue a career in politics?
No, I'm not. I was able to stand my ground, and I was never in a position where I was being forced to make a tough decision about when I was being harassed. I don't have that recollection, but clearly that is what we heard this week from Elena Hampton. And I'm certain that there are many, many young women and some men who have been victims of this behavior. And it is a culture that needs to change. So Carrie's book is one of many courageous efforts to document the kind of thing that Elena Hampton experienced. I think that the floodgates are going to open. I think that the speaker terminated a staff person because of it. This movement has a lot of momentum. Is it not going to go away? And I believe that the message will be that the Old Boys Network will not silence women, and this is going to continue.
You said, and you told Carrie this, that you received personal coaching about how to handle abusive behavior, and you learned to you said you've learned to put up a barrier to literally look at those people and say, stop it. What do you say to younger women in politics who aren't being treated equally?
Well, I think that that's definitely something that they need to learn. But again, in a perfect world, women don't have to say stop it. There should be consequences for bad behavior. The people who leave a job should be the perpetrators. And Elena worked in a political environment where she didn't know where to go. And anywhere she went, she felt she was going to be punished. And that's not right.
Do you think that there exists a system in place right now in Springfield where this environment can be stopped, where there is a place for women to go, where we are saying this is not acceptable anymore?
I think that we began to create an infrastructure under the dome that had a path to a solution and a place, a safe place for people to go. They're always welcome to hire outside counsel, but I think that from what I've noticed, people typically want to go to someone they trust, somebody who doesn't have a conflict, somebody who's going to stand up for them and be supportive of their plight and help them work through it. I'm not sure that Elena met that kind of situation. And I do believe that we need to take a look at what happens on campaigns and find remedy for contractual employees who are abused and put upon the same way. So the same belt and suspenders we put on in the bill that we passed in November needs to be put, we need to review how we create that same kind of path and remedy for people working in campaigns.
And do you feel like you are, it sounds like you feel like everything is moving in the right direction in the Capitol. What else needs to happen from a lawmaker standpoint? Not just, and I'm not just talking about laws, I'm talking about training and those sorts of things.
Well, I think that we need to look outside of government to see what models are good. I think that smaller interactive group training seems to be very effective. I think that we as a task force are exploring the best practices. We need to take a very close look at the statute of limitations and independent counsel.
Do you think your colleagues are open to that, having this kind of peer-to-peer training or having groups? Do you think, are people open to hearing this?
I think that the hands of public policy, or the sands of public policy, I should say, are shifting. And what they may not have been supportive of a few months ago or a year ago, I believe that the hearts and minds of many people under the dome are changing and lawmakers are changing. I mean, you see what happened to high-ranking members of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House when there were people acting badly amongst their staff. So I would imagine that many people in policymakers and lawmakers are taking this very seriously and are looking at what works and not being resistant to it.
That's Representative Sarah Feigenholtz. She's a Democrat. She represents Illinois' 12th House District, which includes Lakeview, Lincoln Park, near North neighborhoods in Chicago. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Representative. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Excitement about blockbuster comic book movies is nothing new. Every year there's at least one highly anticipated release. Fans come out early to buy tickets, people dress up as their favorite character, and blogs and social media go back and forth wondering how true to the source the film adaptation will be. Now we have the latest Marvel superhero come to life, Black Panther.
I have seen gods fly. I've seen men build weapons that I couldn't even imagine. I've seen aliens drop from the sky.
Yeah.
But I have never seen anything like this.
How much more are you hiding?
Hola! Let's go!
Well, superhero movies aren't anything new. There does seem to be something exciting in the air when it comes to Black Panther. Is it the film itself or the specific moment we're living in? Joining me to talk about all of this is The Real Critic, that's R-E-E-L, critic Reggie Ponder. He's a member of the African American Film Critics Association and is the resident film critic for Vocalo 90.7 FM in Chicago. Hey, Reggie, welcome to The 21st.
How are you?
I am very excited about Black Panther, and I want to invite everyone who's listening to share your thoughts. It is in theaters. If you've seen it or you're hoping to, you can tweet us at 21STShow. Reggie, you've seen the movie, and I cannot wait to hear your thoughts. Do not worry. We will not have any spoilers. I feel like I should say not for me, because I'm not going to be able to see it until this weekend. But for people who maybe haven't been paying attention to all of the excitement around this, can you tell us a little bit about the movie, or at least the premise of Black Panther?
So the premise is that this, firstly, this movie was developed by two white guys in 1966, the comic book character. It was a breakthrough even back then, because having a black character with their own comic book was one of those things like, what? Really? Wow. And so it shocked a lot of folks in that regard, and actually made a lot of people very, very happy, especially as it relates to African-Americans, to be able to see someone that looked like them in comic books. And so that is one of the things that's making this movie so exciting. Now, what the movie is about is that the king of Wakanda is the Black Panther. And that his name is T'Challa, and he is coming to the throne. He has a lot of challenges. He has challenges to the throne. He also has challenges as to what to do with the throne and how to protect his country, as well as whether he should share the riches of his country with the world.
And can you tell us a little bit about the director of this film?
The director is Ryan Coogler, and one of the things when you made my introduction is that I've been also the resident critic of the American Black Film Festival for a long time, and Ryan Coogler won the 2011 ABFF HBO Short Film Competition for a film called Fig, and he won $20,000 from that competition, which helped to kickstart his next project, which was 2 years later, which is Fruitvale Station, and that was about Oscar Grant and the killing of Oscar Grant in the Oakland area, and that was also played by Michael B. Jordan.
And lots of critical acclaim for Fruitvale Station. How is it, and that's a really different than blockbuster action, you know, Marvel movie.
Yes. So then he did the movie Creed, and I think that also gave him a little bit of notice, because he was able to bring Sylvester Stallone back to the big screen in the role, in that whole Rocky role. And Sylvester said that he wasn't coming back, but he was convinced by a Coogler to do so. So obviously this movie, which is the Black Panther, is his biggest budget and movie to date. It is rumored to be at least 150, and some folks are saying that it's a $200 million film.
Wow. And so, Reggie, the social media around this has been insane. The New York Times said the black internet, to put it mildly, was exploding about this movie. But the teaser for the trailer, not even the full trailer, had 89 million views in 24 hours. It was the most tweeted about film of 2017, according to Twitter. And it wasn't even released last year. Why is everyone so excited about this,
Reggie? Well, you already alluded to it. Firstly, this is the first major superhero movie with a black director, a black lead character, black writers, and a predominantly black cast. It also addresses issues of colorism, which we'll talk about, maybe get into a little bit. It's also a vision of how blacks see ourselves being strong, independent, smart, caring, and proud. And it really doesn't hurt that it's coming out during the Me Too, Time's Up movement, as women are very important to T'Challa's success.
We actually have a clip that relates to that. Let's do that and then introduce some of the cast that's going to be in this.
Queen Mother, Princess, my comfort for your loss.
Thank you, Nakia. It is so good to have you back with us.
Take her to the River Province to prepare her for the ceremony.
Yes, General.
Did he freeze?
Like an antelope in headlights.
Are you finished?
That's a little bit from Black Panther. That's Chadwick Boseman, Lupita Nyong'o, Angela Bassett, Danai Gurira, and newcomer Letitia Wright. Reggie Ponder's here with me talking about this film. He's the real critic. Some of those names are familiar for some folks. Danai Gurira, I think, has gotten so popular because of The Walking Dead.
That's right.
What can you tell us about this cast, and particularly these women?
So the first thing is that it is a Pan-African cast. It's an international cast, but from a Pan-African perspective, you have Lupita Nyong'o playing Nakia. She's from Kenya by way of Mexico. You have Danai Gurira, who is the general, and she's by way of Zimbabwe. You have Letitia Wright, who plays Shuri, the sister of the king, and she's from Guyana in the Caribbean. And then, obviously, we have Angela Bassett, who is, USA. But it is a Pan-African cast, and they're speaking actually a South African dialect for this movie. You have Daniel Kaluuya from London. You have John Kanai, who is a very well-known South African actor. He plays the Black Panther's dad. He was the original Black Panther. So it has a very diverse cast, and they look marvelous on the screen.
I'm speaking with Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. the real critic, about the new movie Black Panther. So, Reggie, you mentioned this at the beginning. The character was originally created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby to Jewish New Yorkers. It was introduced by Marvel in 1966, a very different time in America. What do you think is so special about this Marvel character?
Well, I want to point out something that's really interesting to tell you how important the character is. And then I'll talk a little bit about what's interesting.
Sure.
Is that one of the things, if you remember Spike Lee's movie, Do the Right Thing, when bugging out goes off on a man who ran over his $100 Jordans, he gets really mad at this guy who's wearing a Boston Celtics Larry Bird jersey. And even then, the significance of the Black Panther came out, because in that scene, one of the characters says to him, "The Black Panther would kick your ass." And so even back then, Spike Lee knew how important the Black Panther was to our pride and how we felt about that particular character. Again, it's a Black superhero who's not beholden to the Western world, or what they call the colonizers. He's the protector of a country and a way of living, and he's determined not to let the colonizers steal the precious resources, which is vibranium, like has been done with gold and oil in other African countries. And then they also show this man who's not perfect and has to grapple with what kind of king he might be, and a man who's not afraid to work alongside women. In fact, they work alongside so well. So I think that gives you a lot of reasons about what's so special about the character and why it resonates for people even today.
Well, and I think this also stylistically is a reflection of Afrofuturism, right? And that's sort of a movement looking at Black people existing in the future, and an alternate future even in some ways, right? Like, there's so many different... Now, when we talk about Afrofuturism, we think about musicians like Janelle Monáe, as opposed to kind of like back in the day, like the Parliament, George Clinton kind of people. But I'm just thinking about writers like sci-fi writers like Octavia Butler.
That's right.
And wondering now if this is a moment where this is coming into the mainstream, where this isn't something, and by mainstream I mean people who are not Black as the rest of the country kind of knowing more about this, especially as I think about A Wrinkle in Time. Ava DuVernay is that's coming out in a couple of weeks as well. That's an Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon adaptation. I've read that she and Ryan Coogler are very much admirers of each other. Do you think that we're seeing a little bit more of maybe this becoming more of a mainstream?
I can't say. What I'll say is that I think that now is the time for it. Will it last? It'll be something to watch. And the reason I say that is that if you remember back in the day when you had the Spike Lees and the John Singletons of the world, there was this thought that there was going to be this whole renaissance, this whole movement with the John Singletons and Spike Lees of the world, where everyone felt that there was going to be this whole renaissance of African-American movies. Well, that died out. As you know, just recently we were talking about, not only the 4 years ago were we talking about Oscars So White. So the hope is that this can live, where you can see different people of different colors, African-Americans front and center in the screen, in science fiction, technology, and ancient African mythologies. But who, you know, time will tell whether this is just a moment in time or a wrinkle in time, if you will, and as opposed to something that will last a longer time.
Right. And I mean, I for one, I've been Octavia Butler is one of my favorite sci-fi authors. I'd love to see film adaptations of her work. We should talk about the music for this, right? The soundtrack is on track for number one album, the music curated by Kendrick Lamar. Let's just hear a little bit of that. Reggie, how do you think the music worked?
The music in this worked fantastic. So someone asked me, did you bring your biases to this movie? Did you like it because you have all these biases? And I was like, yes. Yes. I mean, you cannot go into this, at least I cannot, as an African-American man, not having seen movies like this in this type of a fashion, to not like it so much. And the music really works very, very well. You talk about this whole Afrocentric movement, is that the music works with that. Coogler, I think that what they did with this music is place the songs in the right places. There's a couple of scenes where they show the beauty and the majesty of Africa, debunking the myth of that it's one of those continents that you don't want to go to. The music does a beautiful job when you see the landscape of Africa. Oh my goodness. I think I gotta go. I gotta go back to the movie.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I was gonna say, you didn't give us I'm guessing that your review of this, we should end on that. It sounds like you think it all delivered. Without giving anything away, what should people expect to see? What did it leave you with?
Oh, I get a chance to do this? Okay, so here it is. The Black Panther is here, and I really, really like it. I mean, you have a strong black superhero. You have these strong chocolate black women. You have a wonderful, beautiful country in Wakanda. And then you have this technology that will rival anything that Tony Stark has to bring. And then in some cases, you might even think that he is, you might be reminiscent of 007 because these gadgets are so fantastic. But that alone, I get you, doesn't make a great movie, but I think it's a great start. What makes this a great film is that it challenges our humanity. You know, who should we help? Why should we help? It throws in a few twists and turns. I'm not going to give away any of those, spoiler alerts, but it has some superhero action that tells you Marvel put some hot sauce on this one. Oh my goodness. So I'm not going to tell you about the story. I just got to tell you, you have to experience this one for yourself and recognize that this film is more than relevant for this positive black images, because it also highlights some of the challenges black people face, from self-determination to tribal disputes to helping the least of us. I say bold, I say black, I say beautiful, I say four reels, which is my highest. This is a must see. You got to go check this one out.
That's Reggie Ponder, the real critic. If he hasn't convinced you to see Black Panther, I don't know who will. I'm super excited about seeing this. Reggie, everybody, if you've seen it already, tweet to us. We'll tweet out a link to this weekend as well, so everyone can continue the conversation on social media. Reggie, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was absolutely my pleasure. Hope to come back again.
That does it for us today. Thanks to everyone who put together our action-filled week in Springfield, kind of like a superhero movie, everything that happened this week. I want to thank all the folks who work on the 21st, Jason Croft, Steve Mork, Scott Cameron, Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, Libby Foster, and our interns Fatima Farha and Grace Stetson. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.